Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Fun day today. Joined by Brad Johnson. Brad is a principal in a new venture, the Texas Bullpen, which is one of the topics we're going to talk about today. Now, Brad's been on the podcast before. I think the last time was about April.
Yeah, great to be back. I'm sure we'll hit some of the topics we did last time and see if there are any updates, but other changes have occurred since then too.
Yeah, big one. Now, when you were here last time, he was towards, as it turns out, the end of about a 6-year stint at the Texans?
Yeah, six or seven years.
6 or 7, okay. Brad emerged, not to embarrass him, as one of the best reporters on Texas politics, and more specifically, the Texas legislature right now. The change in venue hasn't changed, I think, that, and in watching you on social media and stuff you're writing now. So we'll talk about the substance of things, such as we can get at it. But let's start with the new venture. Tell us about the Texas Bullpen, what you're doing, who you're doing it with, and, what's the niche here?
Yeah, so as far as my area of coverage, things have not changed. I'm still covering Texas politics in pretty much the way I did before, especially right now, focusing heavily on elections. Once we get to the legislative session, heavy on policy in the legislature. But this process actually began like 2 years ago in 24, where this idea popped up. A couple people approached me. The idea was bandied about. A couple different partners that were suggested, talked to, things just never really materialized. So I just kind of put it on the back burner, thought, if I get to it, I get to it at some point. Fast forward to last year, I think it was during the redistricting quorum break policy fight. And a buddy of mine and I, who actually we had talked about doing this 2 years ago, he was among the people I talked to. We're at the bar one night.
Where many good ideas are born.
Yes, of course. Probably had a couple beers, and we're like, just screw it. Let's do this. At what point in our lives are we going to take a risk like this? And so sat down, wrote the business plan, talked to people, got the ball rolling. So I've been working on this for like 6 months, in addition to just having been thinking about it for a year and a half. And so we launched last month on January 12th, after a long time of doing the work behind the scenes to set up a business, which was new for me. I've never done that before. I know how to run a publication. I've never set up a business before. So that was new. And we launched on January 12th. Our main product is a daily morning newsletter called Daily Bowl. It's modeled after, Political Playbook, Punch Bowl News. That was kind of the inspiration. We're also wanting to do longer form reporting when time permits, although time has been, we've realized, really limited because of how much we're producing on the newsletter side of things. But, I also carried over my fourth reading newsletter, more like a weekly analysis of certain topics, carried that over with me. Jonathan, my business partner, is doing it as well. We also managed to get Cassie Schroeder. Your audience may know her as Cassie Pollock. She used to be at the Tribune, was, when I first got here in 2019, one of the top two reporters in the state. And I'd been trying to get her involved in this. She was another one of the people that I talked to back in 24. She had just had another kid. It wasn't a time in her life that she could do it. And so luckily we got her this time, and she's been our editor. It's been great, and I couldn't ask for a better team. It's just been fantastic. The reception's been great as well. People seem to really like the morning newsletter especially, and we're also trying to have fun with it. We're throwing jokes in. We're making not making light of serious topics, but at least throwing some humanity and some humor into something that could be pretty dry as far as a topic set goes.
You know, I've known Cassie for a long time. I'm embarrassed to admit that I didn't recognize that as her married name. So yeah. That's great. Yeah, Cassie's very good. So, you know, what was the burr under the saddle here? In other words, and, you know, I don't want to, you know, I'm not trying to press you in a place, you know, that's uncomfortable necessarily, but, you know, you were riding pretty high. I mean, you know, people were coming to you and it makes sense that you would move, but I'm wondering like what you're getting. Well, let me start with the audience. What is the audience getting from you now that they weren't getting before? What was the, you know, how do you feel like, what do you feel like you're delivering that's different? I mean, I know that you're in the same kind of domain.
Yeah,
but.
Topic-wise, it's the same, which I think people are looking for, especially my audience.
Well, that's the anchor.
Right. And I think it's packaged in a different way, a way that people enjoy more. You know, I've gotten a lot of compliments about the humor in the newsletter, the more stylistic writing. You know, my time at the Texan was great. I wouldn't be here without it. And, you know, I loved working for Connie Burton. It was a best boss I ever had. But, you know, at some point I wanted to branch out on my own, start my own thing, and make my own publication in my vision, you know, and do what I want, basically. You know, that's the reason most people go and be an entrepreneur, right? So it was a time in my life where I was riding high. I hope I still am, reputation-wise, in this, you know, smaller pond of Texas politics. I never had any interest in going to D.C., I really love this niche, and just no better time than now to just do it, you know. And you know, I could say I wanted to make more money, and maybe we collapse and I don't make any money. So right. You know, that's always possible. But it was just the right time to do this, and in addition to having the right team around me, having seeming like the right time. Not just in my life, but in Texas politics. You know, we're entering this wild election cycle, and I'm sure we'll talk about that. We'll be, after about a year in existence, almost exactly a year, we'll be hitting the start of the next session. So it was just a great moment. Things all came together.
Yeah.
And I decided to take the leap.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense to that. I mean, I would almost boil down, you know, you want to do your own thing.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, it's pretty simple. You know, I've been asked if there are any problems at the Texan, like working for, like, did I have any brushes with Connie? No, she was great. She allowed me a lot of freedom and to do my job as I see fit. And I couldn't ask for a better setup and a better intro into Texas politics.
And that does make me want to ask you something I don't think I've ever asked you. Like, when you came to Texas, was it mainly for the job? Had you been interested in coming to Texas? Had you?
I never, because
it seems
Texas
like you've
before.
Pretty much gone native.
Yeah, I have. I'm not leaving. At least I don't foresee myself leaving. You know, when I came here in 2019, I had just gotten laid off from my previous job. The after the election in 2018, I was doing consulting. Campaign consulting. I hated it. It was not fun. Wasn't my thing.
Campaigns suck.
Oh my
from
gosh.
The inside.
Oh yeah, and a few other factors.
I mean,
that I don't
some
get
people
into,
love
but it.
It
was
but...
just yeah. It was not. If you can do it, if that's your skill set, great. Somebody's got to do it. It was not mine. So I by pure happenstance I landed here. You know, I kind of hit rock bottom, and my rock bottom was going and applying, taking an interview for a door-to-door sales job because I'd been unemployed for a month, and I'm like, crap, I need money.
Yeah.
And then the next day, or I went to this interview, walked out after 30 seconds. I knew I wasn't going to do that. And the next day, I got an email from Connie saying, hey, you interested in this job? And packed up all my stuff, moved to Texas. And I would like to think I've gone native, although it's a – you know, whether you're now officially a Texan or not is a bit of a moving target, but I love it here. And, you know, that's my answer to any question about my affinity for the state. It's awesome. I love this political scene. I'm an addict, quite frankly, and that's why I'm not going to leave.
I think it's a good answer. It's, I think it's a good answer. So, you know, you said the business plan. I mean, and I know at this point, trying to ask you about the future is just sort of ridiculous. So we'll just stipulate that. But I mean, you mentioned not to get too down the media rabbit hole here, but, you know, you mentioned kind of the Politico Punchbowl news. I mean, I think Punchbowl is kind of the state of the art on that.
Oh, yeah.
Right now.
Absolutely.
You know, in terms of, you know,
in Politico
comprehension,
was, you know,
insider stuff, tonal, you know, tone,
yeah,
approach. I mean, you know, I guess I'm interested whether you've thought about, you know, what the next growth areas are. Because one of the things that, you know, you mentioned Politico, Punchbowl, one of the things that those brands have done relatively quickly was branch out mm-hmm. into other areas. And they had different strategies, I think, you know, verticals for some events, you know, some kind of, and there's an interesting balance between the newsletter content. And the, I mean, like, I never go to the Punchbowl website.
Yeah.
Hardly ever.
Yeah.
I don't know about you, but.
Not really, no.
So I'm just wondering how you guys are thinking about, not to get too nerdy about this, mm-hmm. but last time you were here, we talked a lot about the evolving media environment and a lot of this.
Sorry, what was the
question? Where do you see this going in a sense? I mean, and again, you know. I don't know. I'm going tomorrow.
Yeah.
It was an acceptable answer.
Yeah. I don't see things changing much in the near future. I mean, we just started, you know, about a month ago. So we have to make sure we can continue to pump out what we're pumping out. You know, I'd like to add another reporter or two, but, you know, the money needs to come in for that, right?
Right.
And so TBD on that. But it's been so far, we've punched well above our weight in terms of output compared with the amount of people we have working.
Yeah.
And eventually we're going to want to, you know, ideally if we do, or if we are successful, we'll add another reporter or two. Maybe we'll add another support staff, but for various things, whether it's, you know, event planning or the business side,
because
I've been doing a lot of the business stuff, which takes up a lot of time and, you know, makes it hard for me to write particularly the amount that I used to. Which is just a trade-off, and, you know, I have to do this, right? So I've never thought about having when I planned this out, I never thought about really going to D.C., getting a D.C. reporter. If the right opportunity pops up, maybe. But I think our niche is Texas politics.
That's not really what you're doing.
No, it's not. And, you know, if that were to happen, it would be a focus on Texas members,
yeah.
right? We're not covering all of Congress. That's just not the point. And also, why try and jump into that, you know, very large pond media wise yeah. as a very tiny fish that's not even there, you know? So,
and I would observe it, you know, I don't want to, this could be insulting to a lot of people that I know, and I don't mean it that way, but I think a lot of the Texas focused outlets that have invested in DC coverage, I often wonder if what the return is,
yeah.
especially given the state of play in Congress where, you know, I mean, you're doing a lot of covering of why Congress isn't doing anything.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's a little bit of a simplification, but
well,
not
it's not
too
far
much.
Off. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you almost kind of have to check the box, or at least I think that's the way they look at it.
Yeah, I think so too.
And because, you know, we do care about the U.S. Senate race here, which matters right. in the context of Congress, right? We do care about the redistricting fight, which matters in the context of Congress. But I think Texas outlets have a tendency to take their eye off the ball when they lean too heavily into congressional stuff. And, you know, bread and butter here is the Capitol. And we've already had... We probably talked about this the last time. We've already had a massive shrinkage of the press pool in Austin. It used to be, what, 75-ish people? That's what I've heard from some of the old hats. And now we're down to, you know, maybe 30. And a good number of those aren't even during session, aren't even there every day.
Right.
So this space needs more focused issue-specific coverage. And that's kind of the niche that I filled before I did this, and I hope to fill with this new outlet.
Okay, that's interesting. Well, you know, good luck.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, and it's, you know, I mean, it's, you know, as I'm listening to this, my first response is, and this is, as you know, working in a pretty small operation myself, man, you know, keeping that content flow is very difficult over time.
Yeah.
after a while, when you were saying, well, you know, I'd like to get another reporter, it's going to come a point where you're going to like it a lot.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I suspect, especially the way you're describing how your role is evolving.
Yeah.
You know, your management too now. So
workflow wise, you know, if we were just doing newsletters, it would be fairly easy, I would say. But we're also wanting to do other writing, get on the road more, because that's where how you actually cover this stuff.
And, right.
Particularly at the beginning of this, I've been not exactly chained to my desk, but I got to do all the business stuff, right? So I can't just go on the road constantly.
If you're on the road, you're in a Holiday Inn Express.
Right.
Working on a spreadsheet at night.
Right. But if we are, once we, you know, get things all settled and things get a bit on that side automatic, you know, it'll never be totally automatic, but closer to that, then there will be more time for us to, you know, go into the Capitol and spend all day watching a House floor fight. You know, that's the kind of stuff that I love about this job that makes it worthwhile to me. You know, I could go cash out and be a hack if I wanted to, but that just, it's not enticing because I've done that before and it's not fun. You know, the paycheck would have to be really good for me to take that.
Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, sleeping at night comes with a cost.
Yes.
Yeah. So let's, you know, we wanted to, you know, survey the election landscape and check in on vibes and races and stuff. But you and I were talking before, and I can't help but say, man, this El Paso laser story is weird.
It's
still yet, you know, as we were saying, has not really yet revealed itself. Like, what are you hearing from both reporting and in the ether and, you know, sources, et cetera?
Well, the official story seems to be that there was some drone operation, whether that was by the cartels or by our own military, and there was no coordination, no say-so, you know, move between the various branches. We don't know that yet. It seems to be the official story was they were cartel drones, and they were shot down. Now, the weird thing that's not lining up to me is, and, you know, it possibly could be explained by them just operating out of an extreme abundance of caution, but 10 days initially shutting down the entire airport, and not just the airport, but the airspace below 18,000 feet, that doesn't really add up for just, you know, a few drones that either were mistaken for hostile actors or were hostile actors. But then again, I'm just a Texas politics reporter. I'm not a national security guy, so I don't know for sure. But something's a little odd there, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think there was reporting, I think, in the New York Times this morning. I think it was, you know, and I don't know exactly what the story's been evolving very rapidly, as we were saying. You know, they closed the airport for 10 or 11 days for about 3 hours before that all got shifted around. Yeah. That, you know, these were, you know, this was some kind of laser tool that was on loan from the Department of Defense to Border Patrol. And that was kind of the venue of that. And then you have this response from the FAA. I mean, I find like...
So they were like testing the laser...
Right.
Weapon on drones, and they were mistaken. Okay.
But whose drones were they?
Yeah, right.
Right, we don't know. And, you know, I mean, I remember a time when, you know, people were getting in trouble for shining laser pointers at airplanes. So you would think that there would be a little more process involved here.
Yeah.
Unless it was, you know, something very emergent, but that's why I think the initial response, like, this was clearly an emergency, we didn't have time.
Or, yeah. Well, you know, one thing...
But I don't know how much that's going to hold up based on what the reporting is looking like.
Yeah. One thing you learn when you're working, as you and I do, this close to either... to any kind of bureaucracy, but especially government bureaucracy, is a lot of just stuff just happens that people don't expect, and they react. And, of course, we're humans, so we overreact a lot of times.
Yeah.
And, like, things happen. And that's not to say that there aren't... there's not corruption or bad decisions made. Of course there are, but a lot of times there's no like grand conspiracy, no puppeteer behind the scenes pulling the strings. There's a bunch of people that are exercising power in different ways and counteracting ways. And that causes, you know, just unintended consequences.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like the, you know, I don't know if this is in your wheelhouse or anything. Sort of like the Don DeLillo portrayal of the Kennedy assassination, there's all these forces at work and they're interacting in ways that, you know, everybody has an illusion of control and guidance, but really it's just interacting in ways that, you know, often produce bad outcomes.
Right. Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think the bureaucratic rivalry piece here and, or, you know, the, it's hard not to feel a certain amount of tit for tat here when somebody feels like they weren't consulted. It's like, well, we'll just declare the airspace closed for 10 days. It feels a little like a little bit of a pissy response that is exactly the kind of thing you're talking about where.
Well, and then when you add the fact that, especially currently, but this is the case in a lot of administrations, nobody wants to take blame for anything.
Yeah.
They just want to blame everybody else. And, you know, even if it's something trite.
I don't think it makes you a never Trumper to observe that in this administration, nobody really wants to take the blame for stuff because the punishment can seem sudden and severe and a little capricious at times, and it's very unpredictable.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, that ebbs and flows based on administration. And there have been other ones that have been at least somewhat like that before.
Yeah, sure.
So it's kind of human nature bearing itself out in a massive, you know, presidential administration.
Right. It's just something, you know, lasers and drones makes it sort of more provocative.
Yes. Right? I mean, makes just, a great headline.
Right? Well, and, you know, closing the airport was kind of a, you know, it was a tension grab.
Yeah.
Doesn't happen all the time. All right, so let's you know, we'll move into more traditional territory. So I kind of want to use, you know, before, you know, I keep saying we're going to get to elections and we're 20 minutes into it, but I also want to ask you about something else that you've covered that I read about on your website today, which really caught my eye, and that's, I'm wondering what you make of the initial ESA applications and the demographics of that. Because, you followed that debate, and in some ways, this is the first report on, okay, like, whose predictions were kind of on target.
Is this just a bunch of rich people getting these?
Yeah, and about who's going to benefit from this and what it looks like. So I'm wondering what you make of it.
You know, I think it shows that—
You know what? Let's share it. I've got this, let's just share it real quick. I should have done that. So, you know, what you guys report is that according to the comptroller's office— 80% of the applicants said they intended to use the stipend towards private school. 20% say that they have eyes toward homeschooling, and that, which I thought was interesting, actually. I'm curious.
That's a larger percentage than I thought it was going to be. But, you know, it's an option available, right?
Yeah, right. I mean, I don't think there's any weirdness there, but I think it is. It's an interesting piece of – it's one of those things that there was a lot of discussion of that we now finally have at least something, you know, basically one in five.
Yeah. Well, the other side of it is monetarily, the private school ESA voucher, whatever, it's, you know, I think like $10,000, up to $10,000 a year. The homeschool one is much lower at $2,500.
Right.
So there is a – even though percentage-wise you have 20% of applicants wanting to do homeschool, it's not 20% of the money.
Yeah. Yeah. And then in terms of, you know, one of the other, you know, things that you already alluded to is, you know, who's going to benefit from this class-wise. And that was interesting. I mean, so 34% of applicants had come from four-person households with incomes of 200% or below the federal poverty line, so $66,000 a year.
For a family of four,
For a family of four. And the same family of four, you know, baseline, 37%, so little more than a third in each category, between 200 and 500%. So that's between 66 and then 165, which hits into that who's going to benefit from this. And then 29% from four-person household with income above 500%, which would be above that 165 threshold. So what do you think of that policy-wise? But you know, maybe more importantly for the kind of conversations we have, what do you think about it politics-wise? Seems to me there's a little bit of in here for everybody.
Yeah,
is the way I
absolutely.
Would read this.
And you know, like people that really hate this program and really opposed it, they'll really focus in on that 30% above 500% of the federal poverty line. I think a good gauge is what do the people think about those numbers who were skeptics but eventually voted for it. And from what I've heard, they're kind of happy with where this is landing. You know, I think they would prefer more of it, if not all of it, being reserved for people under 500% of the FPL.
Which was a debate.
Was a debate, yep. And I think, if I remember correctly, during that debate, you ran into, it's not exactly like 14th Amendment equal protection side of things, but it's kind of along the same lines.
Yeah,
like,
I think people were too mindful of the optics of that not being great. Yeah. But there, that was kind of the implication.
But, you know, what this shows is that, for the most part, people who are above 500% of the FPL, they don't feel like they need to apply for this as much. And you're seeing a lot more, at least percentage-wise, of the applicants being, and it's of 80,000, I think roughly 80,000 people, 90,000, I think, actually, applicants. You're seeing a lot more of those people, the people who it's, this is actually kind of designed to help, going for it. And they feel like this is a worthwhile program. So, you know, the other aspect of this, and I'd been comparing this rollout kind of to the Obamacare rollout, and where you had this big break of people who qualified for the subsidies but never applied because they never wanted to go through the bureaucracy.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think we're seeing that problem play out right now. Now, maybe once the legislature expands it, which frankly they probably will, then we'll start to see some of that. But the application rate, from what I'm hearing from the comptroller's office and the vendor, it's blown away their expectations.
Really?
The number of people that have applied. Now, that said, there's surely going to be flaws that come out in this, right? There always are in a program this big.
Yeah.
The legislature is going to have to come back at some point to fix issues here and there. So the jury's still out on whether this is an effective program, but so far they're happy with where it's gone.
Right. I mean, because, you know, it's interesting that they're happy with the flow of applications. You know, it's not a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, in Texas.
Yeah. Well, there's also, they have a $1 billion cap.
Yeah.
Right now on this. There's no specific student cap, but the monetary cap exists, and they only appropriated $1 billion. Now, that'll probably grow, and then we'll see, is there enough demand to meet that?
Right.
So.
Well, the only $1 billion is an interesting, since for a long time, I think there was a point when advocates thought, wow, if we could get $1 billion, we're kind of cooking with grease here.
Yeah.
It's an interesting indication of where the debate is run that, you know, you kind of say, well, it's only $1 billion and there's going to be more.
Well, yeah. What happens if the economy takes a downfall, a tumble, and, you know, we end up with, there's a lot of talk about, you know, our friend Harvey Kronberg talks about a lot, the possibility of a economic downturn and then having no surplus. And then what do you do when you actually have to cut the budget? It doesn't look like things are going that way. We had Comptroller Kelly Hancock on the podcast yesterday. He was saying that the sales tax remittances are actually pretty good.
Yeah.
And so we'll probably have another decently sized surplus, but eventually that's not going to happen. Eventually, at some point, we will be in a situation where we have to cut spending. And at that point, is this thing on the chopping block, or are we looking elsewhere in order to preserve this?
So. And some of those, you know, sales tax surpluses, and I think the last comptroller talked about this a little, you know, pretty directly at one point, did come from rising prices. And so there's a countervailing, you know, piece of that in terms of trying to think about what the revenue is going to look like.
Well, and also just a reignition of the economy after COVID. It's still kind of ongoing. You know, we're not as – it's not as much of a steep incline as it was in 21 or –
right.
22, 23, but, you know, it's still climbing a bit compared to what it was then, right?
Yeah, so. Sure. All right, well, I was interested in hearing what you thought about that. I mean, I wonder about the homeschooling piece, mm-hmm. mainly because I think that's probably you never know. But in looking, you know, I'm a little unprepared for this, so you can just, I could be a straw man here, but you know, it feels to me like the potential for us discovering down the road that the requirements for reporting on that spending could be a problem.
Now there are.
It seems more open to potential abuse than the others.
You know, the one argument that one of the arguments that the supporters of this had is, and particularly in the debate, is it's not a voucher. Because this is an account that has to get permission to spend money from the comptroller's office, right? So there is a permission structure there that you need in order to spend it. So that probably does prevent some of that. But yeah, who the hell knows? There's always going to be issues.
Right, it's the nature of the thing in practice. Like, you know, it's like taxes. Right. I mean, once you create, you know, the ability to, you know, justify your costs, even if you're getting signed off on, you know, there's a, it's an invitation to find.
I'm sure there
areas.
Will be abuse. There absolutely
you know,
will
I mean,
be.
And I'm not saying it the whole thing, but I'm just curious, like, I am curious about what the magnitude of that is going to be.
Well, I can guarantee you that the first instance of that is going to get a whole hell of a lot of media coverage whenever there's a lawsuit filed. That's for sure is going to happen.
Okay, so let's go to races. Let's go to the election environment. Let's start like with a vibe check. We're, you know, you and I were last together in a public conversation in December for the PAP meeting with a couple other of our friends and, you know, our friends in the lobby in the audience. You know, I kind of felt like as of that meeting in early December, we were still really kind of reading mostly subterranean tea leaves.
Well, I don't think
races.
We even knew what the fields looked like yet because that was before the filing deadline.
Right. And, and it was just, you know, as I was kind of.
Jasmine Crockett hadn't jumped in yet.
There you go. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. And as I was kind of, I think it was right before, right?
Yeah, it must, I think like it was, the third, she jumped in on filing day, which was the 8th.
Right.
Yeah.
So, it was, I mean, I think we were all anticipating.
The writing was on the wall.
But it wasn't there. But, you know, the overall point being. You know, we're, it feels now like, you know, we're in the thick of it.
Yeah.
So give me a vibe check and you can start where you want. What's the vibe out there in the respective primary, in those respective parties?
I mean, it's certainly an odd cycle in terms of the number of open seats statewide. Yeah. I think that is by far the thing that's marking this election in some form of uniqueness. But in my mind, I look at this and I'm comparing it to 24. You know, I see the way Governor Abbott's acting, the endorsements he's making. Other than the Senate race, I see where the different factions are kind of falling on all these candidates. And it looks like a reversion to the mean in terms of how cycles before 24 kind of played out. And you know, whether we're talking internal party fights or, you know, positioning ahead of November, Democrats versus Republicans. It just looks more familiar to me than 24 because that was just such an anomaly of an election, anomaly of a cycle for many different reasons. Now, of course, you add in the fact that this is probably going to be a pretty good cycle for Democrats. Question is how good. I still don't think it's going to be a 2018 level. I think overall the state has shifted rightward enough that you'll see some of that blunted. But Democrats are going to make some gains compared to where they are now.
Yeah.
Absolutely. No question. We already saw that in SD9, which was just a crazy upset. Although there's, if you want to talk about that we can. There's some pretty interesting details that explain it more than just, oh yeah, Democrats were really motivated to vote against Trump.
Yeah, I sat with Ross Hunt at an event yesterday, and you know
he's having a bit of a moment.
He really is.
That. I'm glad for him because he's been good.
I kind of congratulated him on that. It's like, you know, and you know, I thought. Part of the reason he did so well, and this is like, you know, two weeks in a row of talking about Ross, so here's to you, brother. But, you know, part of what I think helped work was the way he had like a little, he did very deep, you know, good comprehensive data. But then the way that he kind of summarized that, he had two or three talking points that I thought were really easy for people to get from different perspectives. And I thought it really helped.
Yeah. He hit the nail on the head. You know, I had the digital guy for the Wamsgans campaign texts me separately after I put Ross's thing out, his data out. He goes, yeah, Ross hit the nail on the head. It was spot on. So follow Ross Hunt for some pretty good election takes. But there's one aspect of that race that I think we should touch on. It's a hyper-localized aspect.
Yep.
And it was the Keller ISD attempted split that happened, I believe, in 24-25. You had Keller ISD is, I think, the biggest school district in that SD9 district. And there was an attempt by some, or at least consideration, to split it into two districts. And basically, the Keller ISD side would remain and be the wealthier, more affluent parts of the district.
The new improved Keller ISD.
And then cut off the lesser, the I don't think there's anyone that's totally impoverished. It's not like slums. But, you know, there's less affluent areas.
Sure.
Cut them off and push them into a new district. Now, it didn't happen. There was a lot of pushback, and it kind of got smothered in its crib. But someone who was behind that, or at least a huge player in it, was Lee Wamsgans, who was at the time running Patriot Mobile Action PAC. And I think that pissed a lot of people off.
Left a lot of bruised suburban feelings, and suburban feelings are bad to bruise.
Absolutely. And if you have, if you, especially for Republicans right now, because they are bleeding in the suburbs, and maybe they can counteract it by November. It's certainly possible. We don't know, right? But that hyper-localized aspect, it took what was probably going to be a really razor-tight finish between the two and pushed Taylor Remmett, you know, into the margin that we saw. And if you look at the breakdown, the Keller ISD side of things, or at least what would have continued to be Keller ISD, all went with the Republican Wambsgans by quite a bit. And then if you look at the other side, these parts that were going to get cut off, they all went very heavily for Remmett. When if you look to 4 years ago with Kelly Hancock's last election, that's all bright red.
Right.
So there's a, I mean, there's a very clear factor there to consider that I don't think, you know, especially national media is not, they're not, they don't know about. And so they're not talking about it. And that is what made that race so much weirder than what it otherwise would have been.
You know, probably more, you know, well, we could speculate about that. But I mean, I think keying off of Ross's analysis, that's where you lost probably more middle income, kind of what we think of as maybe populist Republicans, and those independents that voted in, you know, pretty clearly lopsided.
Well, and the main point of, at least in my opinion, the main takeaway of Ross's analysis is that there's no way Remmett could win this seat without polling almost all of the independent voters and a good chunk of the Republicans. You just, and certainly not by the margin that he did, that Remmett did win. So, you know, actually, I want to add one more thing. Taylor Remmett, and this is something Democrats, it's a little too late now because the fields are already set, but Remmett was a perfect casting call for that district.
Yeah.
You know, a suburban white dude who looks normal and talks normal, and he's a union guy, a machinist who works for Lockheed Martin.
Yeah.
For that district, that is just perfect. And, you know, we kind of saw Democrats really realize that, first of all, that candidate quality matters, but also the fit for the district does too. We saw that in Virginia and New Jersey last year in November. Well, apply that to here too. And Democrats need to take that to heart. And you can't run AOCs everywhere. You can run AOCs in certain places, but if they want to really make gains, then they need to get candidates that fit the district. One that really does is Bobby Pulido down in South Texas and Texas 15. That's one that I think Democrats really could flip that Republicans have not really been thinking about.
So that's a good, perfect transition. I want to talk, I want to jump in there and talk about what parties can and can't do, but we'll do that another day.
Okay.
So, talk a little bit about a couple races you're watching here that you mentioned, the Bobby Pulido race, but what else are you watching and what's out there and that you find revealing?
Well, let's talk about the five seats that that Republicans are hoping to pick up from the redistricting.
Right.
I don't think they're going to pick up all five.
I don't think anybody really believes that anymore. No. That I mean, people are so people was, still saying it.
Yeah. But when it was drawn, there was certainly a chance, but that was before we knew how good this election cycle is shaping up to be for Democrats. So those five, one in North Texas, I think will go red, regardless of who the Republican nominee is. I think the one in Houston, CD9, will still go red, regardless of who the Republican nominee is. And there we have an interesting fight between Briscoe Cain and Alex Mueller. They're just clobbering each other constantly.
Yeah. With very blunt instruments.
Yes. Yes.
Say the least. Yeah. Put it politely.
So I still think that's an R60 district. And in a really bad cycle for Republicans, that Democrats could hold that seat. I just don't see
it. We're talking galactically really bad,
right,
though.
Right. Yeah. Now, you look at the three in South Texas, you've got CD35. That one, I still probably give the edge to Republicans, but they have a good candidate, Democratic candidate, presumptuous candidate, John Lira, and then a Republican field where nobody's really separating themselves.
Yeah.
You know, maybe John Lujan wins that. Maybe it's Carlos de la Cruz or Josh Cortez. But do any of those names jump off the map to you?
Right.
No. But then you look down.
But to your point, about the localization of these elections, it's hard to be sure whether they're jumping, you know.
Right.
What absolutely. Jumping off would look like from the outside.
Yeah. And then you get the two in South Texas with the two Democratic incumbents, Henry Cuellar's district and Vicente Gonzalez's. 34 of Gonzalez's seat, the Republican primary, is fascinating. It's basically become the battle of the two Floreses.
Yep.
And you've got Myra Flores, who's been running in that race for a couple cycles now and lost each time. She's been totally abandoned by the Washington establishment that backed her the last two cycles.
They've given up, I think. Yeah.
Yep. And I've heard various reasons I won't go into, a lot of its personality, but they've backed Eric Flores, and Eric is the only one that's spending any money right now. And I think it's because he realizes Myra could possibly win without a runoff, but the more money he spends, the less and less likely that the case is. You know, their strategists told me specifically that their plan the whole time, Eric Flores's, was to make a runoff, and they think they have a better shot once they get there. Now, Donald Trump came out and endorsed him, so that's an interesting wrinkle there, and of course helps Eric Flores, but is it enough to get over the hump on this? And then in Cuellar's district, you've got Tanote Arena, which is the Webb County, former Webb County judge, who flipped parties against Cuellar. And there's so much to talk about there, but I see Republicans' best case scenario winning three of those.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe losing another one in 15. I don't think I'd bet on it. I think Monica de la Cruz will hold it, but it's certainly possible that it's not at all a stretch to say that Bobby Pulido could win that seat.
We've talked a lot about this. The legislature is our focus. I haven't talked much about that. You know, a couple races that you really have got your juices flowing there.
Yeah. Well, things changed quite a bit because there was going to be there still is a tort reform proxy fight. And I think we probably talked about this last time.
Well, but I was going to ask, I wanted to check in on that, how you think that's unfolding.
So broadly, it's changed because Texas for Lawsuit Reform decided to take their ball and go home on races where they were challenging incumbents.
Like right.
Markle Hood in San Antonio was the biggest example of this.
And those were shaping up to be very big fights.
Very big fights. And there's still a good amount of money being pumped in there. You know, for example, I saw, you know, David MacArthur's the Republican, the TLR-backed Republican running against LaHood. Dick Weekly, who is the head honcho at TLR, gave him $100K after TLR said they were pulling out. So we're not seeing like independent expenditures or big money going to MacArthur under the TLR name, but still TLR friendly money is going that way. But they pulled out for a couple of reasons. First of all, the polling was just not looking good. And I was seeing some of it. All these incumbents who are anti-TLR were set to win pretty handily.
Yeah, it was going to be a waste of money.
Yeah. So they pulled out. They're sending their resources elsewhere, specifically open seats. And the big one that I'm watching in that regard is HD 98. That's Giovanni Caprileone's seat. He's not running again.
Yeah.
And you've got Armin Mazzani, who is a trial lawyer himself, against Fred Tate, who's a classic Chamber of Commerce type Republican.
Yeah.
And those two are just killing each other on the airwaves. It's a pretty nasty fight. So I'm watching that one. Two others I'm watching on the Republican side. You've got Terry Leo Wilson down in Galveston against Nathan Watkins. That is a casino proxy fight. There have been less and less of those this cycle. But that is one that Las Vegas Sands feels like there's a vulnerable incumbent there they could take out and send a message. But they've not had a good run of
the last two years. The Sands gambling strategy is like foundation or something. I mean, it's like, how many generations are we planning for this fight?
Well, I mean, the whole plan is to wait out Dan
unkind,
Patrick, right?
But you know what
when
I'm
is
saying.
That happening? You know, when is Dan Patrick out of the way? For all we know, he's running again in 2030, you know? I mean, the last time in 22, he said that was his last one. Well, he's back running for re-election again. So, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of people within the Sands orbit that think, you know, eventually they're just going to be forced to pull out.
Someday we're going to be able to, like, smoke some pot at the casino.
No. Well, they think the opposite. They think this is futile, although Sands is moving ahead full steam.
Yeah.
You know, the posture they're giving off is they're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
And
that's
what
I meant by the foundation, multi-generational planning.
Right. So that one's an interesting one. But then you've got Ken King up in the panhandle, who's the state affairs chair, who pissed a lot of people off last session, including in leadership. Now, he's still an ally of leadership, and he's still one of the boys. But with TLR pulling out of those incumbent races, yeah, that allows them to divert resources to the Tate-Mizani race. But it also allows the Tim Dunn apparatus to divert their resources to other ones, too. And I think at least the spending timeline that I saw adds up to them now going after Ken King pretty heavily, whereas they weren't earlier. And King has been difficult to unseat at all. He's been pretty strong in his district. But we're going to see a test here. How strong is he? Yeah. And the fact that he films a video saying face to camera, don't believe the lies that my opponent's spreading, shows you those attacks are working.
Yeah.
And how effective are they going to be? I don't know. I still think he probably wins, but they're clearly hitting his numbers pretty hard in the district.
You know, the dynamic of that, looking at those races like that, where somebody gets targeted and really beat up on and then survives, is interesting. You think about Drew Darby.
Yep.
You think about, when you go after
how there's no primary against Drew Darby this time.
Right. Well, yeah. When you go after people like that and they survive and they're, pissed, it doesn't really help your problem, I don't think.
Yeah. No.
Put it that way.
Yeah. And then one I'm watching on the Democratic side, which is kind of, it's interesting because it's kind of a twist on what we've seen in the Republican Party primaries for years, which is you have someone from the left primarying, not an establishment member, but someone who's not a super progressive, and Chris Turner in Dallas. And Chris is spending a lot of money. I can tell you he's doing that because he wants to send a message. Don't F with me, basically.
He's been around.
Yeah. And he's got the money to do it, but he's got a progressive challenger, and he's at least worried enough to not just mail it in. Right.
Yeah.
And this, if he wins overwhelmingly, which he probably will, but jury's out on it. Right. I think he sends a message to that wing of the party of, don't come for me, and it's not worth it. It's not worth your time. There's a lot of interesting dynamics happening at the House level. And of course, it's the most interesting chamber. But in the Senate, you've got a bunch of vacancies.
Yeah.
Or open seats. And so that's the main theme there. What happens in those? That Senate seat out in East Texas, SD3, everything else seems like chalk. We can pretty much guess what's going to happen, but nobody knows who's going to win that SD3 seat. That's between Trent Ashby and Rhonda Ward on the Republican side. And I've heard a lot of hand-wringing from both sides about how they think that's going to turn out. And something to watch on March 3rd.
That's a good roundup. I want to move up the ballot because we can't not talk about the U.S. Senate race. But I do want to pause for a second and go back. What do you make of the current, it's good reporting, and again, I'd seen that out there about TLR backing out of those challenging incumbents, et cetera. What do you make of that conflict right now? I was talking to who I would think of as kind of a more traditional side Republican consultant, mm-hmm. who kind of felt like eventually this is not this person's words, but the way I read it, eventually this is going to kind of stabilize and cool off, because there's only so much of an audience within the Republican Party for this resurgence of, to oversimplify, the Republican trial lawyer, right? I don't know. How are you reading that? Just because you talked to a lot of people about this, obviously, you're seeing it close.
Well, the Republican trial lawyer side of things is definitely burning hot right now. And those personal injury attorneys, they feel like they have a constituency among the Republican Party that they've never had before. And it's true, they do. And, why wouldn't they try and play more in these Republican primaries to gain ground policy-wise? I think it's also a product of the last cycle where, whether it's right or wrong, and TLR disputes this, but they're blamed for organizing the Paxton impeachment.
Yeah.
And whether it's accurate or not, that's how a lot of Republican voters, especially very active primary voters, but also those that have been elected to the legislature, that's how they view it. And there's no convincing them otherwise. So the only way to get rid of that is to beat them. Now, it's not going to happen, as we discussed, because the numbers just aren't there for them.
Yeah.
You know, the people that are, I think, have every right to be pissed off the most on this are the challengers that had been told money was coming that now is no longer coming.
Had the rug pulled out
rug
from
pulled
under
out
them.
From under them.
Yeah.
But, you know, from the TLR side, I get it. Like, if we're just beating our heads against the wall to fund these races to try and send a message that ultimately all these races are going to fail, these challenges are going to fail anyway, then what's the point in spending this money? The other side of it is, in all these races, they're going up against the speaker because the speaker is defending single incumbent except one. I'll let you guess who that one is. but he's defending every incumbent, Republican incumbent,
right,
in his membership. And that includes all the more business-focused members. Terry Leo Wilson is an example there. And she's backed by TLR in her race, but it extends over to Mark LaHood as well. So this is an attempt by the speaker, as is his job, to shore up his membership because he has to win election in caucus and then on the floor next time as well.
And look, that was the key, was part of the key to his success in the last session was not only not going to war with those guys, but giving them real roles, you know, in the operation of the House and policy areas that they were interested in.
Yeah. I mean, it was a smart, take Mitch Little.
Mitch Little is the example.
Yes. And he was brought in on huge policy fights such as the bail reform and then whatever ended up happening on the border stuff with that. I can't remember the details of it, but the 287G program, I think is the name.
Oh.
Basically contracting with, you know, partnership between sheriffs and the federal government on things. But he was a huge part of those negotiations, and that was because the speaker invited him in. And now, you know, all the talk about Mitch Little running for speaker against Dustin Burroughs is just fatuous. It's not happening.
It's a fantasy of people that were probably not let in as much.
Yeah, and people who live online too much.
Right. Yeah, who think X is, you know.
Well, another part of that is the on March 3rd, there's going to be a lot of people who spend a lot of time on Twitter whose views of – whose assessment of certain races is wildly off. And we know it watching because I've seen polling. And all the polling shows certain things. And I don't really want to jump in on the candidate in those, but it's clearly not going to happen the way they think. And there's going to be a huge meltdown.
Right.
For sure.
All right, so let's talk about the Senate race before we get out of here. You want to start on the Democratic side or the Republican side?
I think the Democratic side is more interesting right now, so let's do that one.
Okay, so what's the vibe check there? Obviously, you know, that race, you know, took a turn that I described as sort of predictable for a Democratic primary for all the attention it got. And there were things that were strange about it, but what did you make of, you know, LaFleur Allred?
Oh, my gosh.
And just your general sense of why you find that race interesting right now.
Yeah. Well, you know, I kind of think it's absurd for him to be trying to convince us that James Tallarico is some racist.
It's a hard lift, man.
The guy who, one of the most progressive members of the House, who gets up every time he has a chance to, giving a prayer, you know, got pretty famous for one of his prayers in, I think, 21. Just like a very universalist, very progressive approach. Some guy who's called every election bill and redistricting bill that Republicans have done, he's called them racist over the last few cycles. We're supposed to believe that all of a sudden he harbors, you know, animosity towards
black men.
Come on now. That's just silly.
So,
you know, if I have no issue with Colin Allred taking a swipe at Tallarico over calling Allred himself mediocre or his campaign mediocre, which is what Tallarico says, you know, turnabout's fair play. I get it. But that's a little ridiculous. I don't believe that. Come on.
Well, I just think it's tactically kind of unsound, you know, because of that. And I also, you know, and you saw that. I mean, I thought, you know, the Crockett campaign's response was very measured, you know, and in a tactical sense was like, you know, sure, you know, somebody else wants to throw, you know, a couple rocks at Jimmy Tallarico as he's pushing this rock up the hill and doing a pretty good job of it at the time.
Yeah.
Pretty good break. But they did not overinvest.
No. And you know, I feel like the race is tightening. Crockett's clearly the front runner. Just from a pure name ID perspective, we kind of see the same dynamic at play in the Republican Attorney General race with Chip Roy. Voters just don't know who James Tallarico is.
Yeah.
Generally, you know, the really active Democratic base does, but the average person who votes Democrat, no, they don't really know the state rep. They do know Jasmine Crockett, or at least more likely to, because she's been on TV.
Yeah, constantly. all the poll, you know, our polling, everybody's polling has certainly showed that, you know, as of the end of last year, last time we were in the field, you know, James Tallarico still had work to do on that front. He was doing it, and I think, but it was going kind of slowly by end of last year. Now, again, to where we started, that was December. I didn't, you know.
Well, then, and now we see both candidates kind of going negative, which, of course, it always is going to be the case, unless you have Greg Abbott, like in 22, where he's just so far out in front of his primary challengers that he doesn't want to acknowledge them. They always go negative. Why? Because negative works.
Yeah.
And Tallarico's got to do it because he has to gain ground. Crockett has to do it because she wants to prevent Tallarico from gaining ground. And we'll see which message wins. And, you know, there's a...
Let me ask you something about that, though. Yeah. Like, what do you take to be each campaign's message? I'm not sure I could answer that right now.
Yeah.
Honestly.
I don't think a specific issue is the focus. I think it's certainly for Tallarico, his message is, I'm the one who can actually win in November. Jasmine Crockett cannot. And you want the evidence is that all the Republicans were jumping for joy when she jumped in the race.
Right.
And I think it's a fairly persuasive message. Now, do voters actually think that far through it?
Yeah, to the extent that voters are that focused on electability. Right. And I think, you know, some people say, well, of course, Democrats are.
Yeah.
But, people can focus on more than one thing.
Yeah.
Maybe not very well or consistently or whatever. But
well, and then Crockett's side is her big thing is tone and posturing against the White House and against Trump specifically.
Yeah.
Tallarico, he has not said Trump much at all. Now, he's criticized the actions of the administration.
Yeah.
He's criticized ICE and what's going on there. But he wants those crossover voters, and he doesn't want to give, if he is the nominee, he does not want to give Republicans the kind of ammunition against him that Jasmine Crockett has. And the big thing there is the comment she made, whether it was out of context or not, it's going to be running an ad by Republicans if she's the nominee. Her saying that, you know, South Texas Hispanics who voted for Trump have a slave mentality.
Right.
He doesn't want to do that because he wants those people that, you know, voted for Trump last time to come vote for him if they're amenable to it. And his view is that's how the only way we can win.
Right.
Crockett's strategy has been focused on mobilizing the Democratic base and mobilizing voter bases that have not been active before. And I don't see that as a successful strategy. I think the only guy who's done that before in any recent memory was Donald Trump on the Republican side and as a presidential candidate. And that was across a whole country that is a lot more level than the
divided state
of Texas is.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I think Crockett wins just because of the name ID thing. But there is Tallarico certainly could. And there's also...
Tallarico's going to start spending. I mean, they've got a lot of money and they're going to start spending it.
Yep.
And I think they're going to probably get, they're already getting some outside money infusions, and I think there will be more.
And you see a lot of the national groups, they want Tallarico.
Yeah.
Because they think he's a better candidate in November. You know, I will say, I don't think this is going to happen, but it would be fascinating if there's a third candidate in the race, not a notable person, but on, I believe, the polling that came out yesterday or 2 days ago from University of Houston, it had this person at 2%. Now, does that hold? I don't know. Probably not. But if that person pulls 2% and then Tallarico and Crockett are so close that nobody gets to 50, oh, man, a runoff on top of all the other runoffs we're going to have? What an electric
summer. And you'll hear the Republicans dancing and you'll be able to hear them all over town dancing. Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay. So you said it's more interesting than the Senate race. Or the Republican side. I'm talk to me about that. Why is that? I mean, not that I think that's not, you know, but I'd be there.
Yeah.
There are things interesting about both those races right now.
Certainly. And there's certainly intrigue in the Republican side. My read on it is things have been kind of settled for a while. You've seen some back and forth, some some messaging, counter messaging. For example, both Paxton and Corning camps are attacking Wesley Hunt.
Yeah.
You know, what does that tell you? But the general thought is, and I think it's probably correct, that Paxton finishes first, Cornyn finishes second, and they duke it out again in a runoff. And yeah. I think that general dynamic has been the case for a while, whereas this recent surge of the Democratic side, that's newer.
You know, right. That, yeah, that makes sense.
Crockett's a newer entrant. Things have campaigns are now all of a sudden going at each other, while Paxton and Cornyn have been going at each other for literally months now.
Yeah.
So that's why I think the Senate side is more interesting at the moment.
The Democratic side, yeah.
Yes, Democratic side. Thank you.
Yeah.
But we're gonna see how this plays out in the runoff.
It's gonna all start getting, you know, the velocity on this is speeding up right now.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think the Hunt, you know, where Hunt winds up is going to be interesting.
Yeah. And the polling's kind of been all over the place on that.
It has.
You know, there's been some that have all three of them kind of neck and neck.
Yeah, that was a campaign poll. That was and it was, you know, it was not implausible. I think that was the
well, there were a couple. One of them was a campaign poll,
the Ragnarok poll.
I don't think I thought that one had Cornyn up top,
up by one.
Well, there was one that had all three of them in like three
within a few points,
within
a
percent of each other. And then one of them was a third party, but still, the feeling is watching closely that it's Paxton, Cornyn, Hunt, and maybe if Hunt catches a few breaks, he can leapfrog Cornyn. But I don't see that.
I'd be
happening.
Pretty surprised by that. But I mean, it's not, who knows? I mean,
Well, and Cornyn's making the same case on his side that Tallarico's making. I, John Cornyn, am a better November candidate. And look at all this polling that shows, you know, whether it's Hunt or Paxton as the Republican nominee, the contests are a lot closer with Crockett or Tallarico in November.
Right. And so. And all that, you know, trying to figure out those November matchups right now.
Yeah, it's also, what's a likely voter for November?
Yeah, right. And, you know, like, you know, we get forced into doing that once in a while, but it's not, that's just a kind of, what you're estimating is not what's going to happen in November. It's something else that's a little different in my view. But, you know, and again, not uninteresting,
right,
in a sense. But, you know, it's hard for me to kind of, you know, put it this way. I mean, I think what's interesting to me is thinking about those matchups in terms of like who comes out of those parties. And part of it is the stylistic contrast, which is very kind of interesting, and who matches up stylistically, whatever the numbers are telling us, you know, is kind of, you know, it's an interesting thought experiment, right? Because, you know, you can see, okay, so if this is, you know, a debate between Jasmine Crockett and John Cornyn is look a lot different than a debate between James Tallarico and John Cornyn.
Yeah.
And then vice versa, right? I mean, and you can see people having different advantages. I mean, I was talking with a Republican activist not that long ago, and he was really worried about the potential of a Tallarico Paxton debate.
Yeah. Yeah. And,
you know, that, which is interesting, right? Because it's style, the style and the substance collision is strange there, right? Fascinating.
If I were a Republican, I would be more worried about a Crockett v. Paxton debate.
Yeah.
I think. Now, I would be more worried about a Tallarico candidacy against Paxton. But as far as if we're just talking debate, I think Crockett would be, although maybe, you know, I don't think her performance was that great in the one debate she did against Tallarico.
Well, you know, I thought, you know, let's talk about that in a minute. But, you know, the one interesting thing about that debate, which we haven't talked about, I thought, was how they both counter-programmed a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think, and especially her, I mean, I think they went into that knowing what her negatives were. And while, you know, you can say she didn't, how she did was, you know, degree. But I thought she did make an effort that she succeeded reasonably at in saying, look, I can at least have talking points about policy.
Yeah.
I'm not here to just be pissed off or aggressive.
It was a different kind of Jasmine Crockett.
Yeah. And I think that probably, you know, I don't know. I mean, that might have done her some good.
Yeah.
you know? But I think the other piece of that, and thinking about this debate thing, we're just speculating now, but, you know, this whole sort of notion of how Tallarico is positioning himself as the more, as a candidate with broader appeal is interesting, because I was thinking when you, you know, I was talking to people recently about the Tallarico-Paxton matchup, and what you were just saying is that I think people forget, you know, that James Tallarico isn't always talking about progressive Christianity and the finer points of theology. And, you know, I kind of said this in another forum yesterday, I'll use the line again, but, you know, he showed in the legislature he can throw a punch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and have it land.
Yeah. And he does it in a, he packages it in a much more pleasant manner, I think, than Crockett does, but, you know, different strokes for different folks.
Right. Right. But it is, I mean, I think people might, you know, and I'm not sure how they leverage that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I think, you know, they try it verbally. I mean, he, you know, they've had commercials where, you know, he says, you know, I took it to the blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But it's a little bit of a secret weapon for him, I think.
Yeah.
But it's just so at odds with the way that this race is kind of lining up with him as the kind of cool, more measured candidate and her as the hot, I'm here to fight.
Yeah. I'm curious to see if he is the nominee, how the religion side of his messaging actually works, because even for, you know, non-rabid Christians, the
I'm trying to think about the 2x2 box.
Yeah. the like lukewarm Christianity, I'm sure it can appeal to some who are, you know, probably more agnostic, but it can also turn off people who might otherwise be, you know, amenable to whatever he's offering. And I don't know which way that's going to go, but
yeah,
you know, it's once you get out of just Democrats, does that even work, or does that hurt him as a candidate?
Yeah.
Versus just not talking about it, which is kind of how Democrats have handled the issue for a
while. You know, I was going to send it to you and I forgot, but, you know, Josh and I put together a bunch of data on like the religiosity in the audience for Tallarico's kind of brand of Christianity. I'll send it to you. But I mean, I think that, you know, there's not a lot of evidence that he gets a lot of traction from that in the primary, or that it's differentiating him.
Well, it's certainly setting the table up for appeal to crossover voters,
right.
I think.
But I agree with you that I, you know, it's one thing if you're just looking at, you know, if the 2x2 is Christian, non-Christian, or religious, non-religious, but part of the argument he's making is that it's more complicated than that.
Yes. Yes. Well, we know how arguments based on complexity go in politics.
Yeah, right.
They don't go very far.
And it may just be that, you know, I'm wondering if we're not going to hear that. I mean, how much we're going to hear about that in the general election? Because in some ways, people are assuming, no, this is the general election play.
Yeah.
But I think it actually worked out, and I don't know if this was by design or just some of the luck, that it became the propellant for him gaining more name recognition.
Yes.
And whether that has legs later on, and whether there's how much of an audience there really is for that. You know, and again, I think that's why people think that it's interesting to imagine there's more space for that potentially in a Tallarico Paxton matchup than there is in a Tallarico Corn. I mean, I kind of feel like Tallarico on a stage with Cornyn is going to look 12 years old. You know what I mean? I mean, in a way that Paxton won't make him.
Or Cornyn will look 1,000 years old.
Yeah,
that's both ways. Yeah.
That could, you know, interesting question, right? I mean, what carries the day in that comparison?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't know if he can divorce himself from that side of the messaging, because it's so integral to him.
Yeah. No, right? And I don't mean he'll divorce, you know, but I mean, you know, what the relative weight of that is, right?
Yeah.
I mean, is that going to show up in the ads or is it or not?
Yeah.
Right. You know, that kind of, what's the mix?
Yeah.
I guess. I don't expect him to, but is it as upfront as it was? Because look, when he broke through late last year, that was, you know, that was the sledgehammer he used to break through.
Well, that's what got him on the Joe Rogan podcast, which was his arguments, I believe, during the Ten Commandments in Schools debate.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I know we're over time, but the last factor here to consider about the U.S. Senate race, and whoever is chosen on either side, what that means for national money, either that's flowing into Texas or doesn't flow into Texas.
Yeah.
And Republicans, they want national Republicans want Cornyn because they don't want to have to spend a ton of money in Texas to
right.
keep the seat. They want to divert it to actual battleground states. And then if you have on the other side, if you have Tallarico, you're going to see a flood of Democratic money in the state. And if not, do they?
It's a harder decision.
Yeah. Do they just take their ball and go home and go elsewhere? Or do they still double down on Crockett?
Yeah.
Now, for me, the most profound impact of that is not what happens in the Senate race. It's how that affects down ballot.
Yeah.
Because if you get a flood of Democratic money, that will ensure that Dems win more seats than they otherwise would have in the Texas House, which I think for them needs to be the mark of a successful cycle.
Yes.
A successful cycle for Democrats is not winning a statewide seat. It's do you make gains in the House? Do you are you competitive on a statewide level, of course?
Yeah.
And how do the judicial elections shake out? Like, are you competitive in those? Do you keep some of those that you won in 2018 that Republicans have been chipping away at?
Right.
Like, there's so much more at stake here than just one seat in the U.S. Senate.
Yeah. I think that's a good place to end. That's good. I think that's a good insight. Brad, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Joe.
Congratulations on the new venture.
Enjoying
reading it. And
check us out at texasbullpen.com, and you can subscribe to get the Daily Bull every morning along with all of our other stuff.
Yeah, and it's a good read, so do it. So thanks again to Brad for being here. As always, thanks to our excellent audio production team here in the Dev Studio in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin. As always, thanks to you for listening. Stay tuned, and we'll be back soon with another Second Reading podcast from the Texas Politics Project. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.